So this all got started because we were talking about recording steps in a text script.
Well, I have a question for you. Let's say that I had a test script. Let's say that that test script included the step as its first step, reboot the test system. Let's say this was for a test script that I was giving you, so that there's other things going on in the test script, but step one is reboot the test system. My question for you is, what does step one mean to you? What do you do when you see step one, if you're running a test script that has step one in it?
Well, there are various pieces of context information that I would have to bring to bear because of the ambiguity I see in reboot the test system. For example, it can mean switching the machine off, pausing a few seconds, waiting for the machine to come back up for me to. Actually, this will be conditioned too by the second step. What is the second step going to be? Because if the second step is log in, I might log in.
Well, the second step is start Windows Media Player.
Okay, so I see a lot of information missing there if you just type that as it sits on what might matter here. Do I have to log in under my own account name? Do I have to log in with administrative privileges? Do I reboot the system by a hard reset, turning it off for a while, by pressing the button, or merely by going to restart system from Windows from the start menu.
So, are you saying you need more information from me?
The first time that I perform this test, I might, or in training, I might ask you that kind of question. Or if I knew that we were testing a piece of hardware, I might infer from the circumstance that I would want to reset the state of the hardware. So a lot of this depends on what has come before.
Come before what?
Come before my reading or executing of the test script.
You mean step one may not mean reboot the test system?
There are a number of different ways to interpret reboot the test system.
Well, what is one way to interpret reboot the test system?
Well, again, as I said, I could shut the machine down. And reboot, by the way, for some people might mean boot it if it's not booted, reboot it if it's not booted already, or boot it
Well, is
if
that
it's
what it
not
means
booted.
to you?
It depends on my context. It depends on
Well, then
where.
ask me what you need to ask in order to settle the question.
Okay. What kind of product are we testing
We're
here?
testing Windows Media Player.
Windows Media Player itself.
We're
Okay.
testing Windows Media Player on this particular version of Windows.
On this particular version of Windows,
Right.
is the variability of the platform an issue here?
What do you mean?
Well, am I running, is this the first test that I am running on this system? Is this the first time I'm set down?
We're running a whole series of tests
Okay.
with testing different applications.
Is this the first test in the series?
It may or may not be. We're going to be running these tests over and over again, and there's a whole series of them, so we may be redoing tests at different times in different ways.
The frustration that I see with this scenario, and again, I think it's a frustration that a lot of people see, is I can't tell by reading the script about a whole lot of things that I'm going to do implicitly based on the situation. So reboot the test system has, as I say, a multitude of potential
Right,
meanings.
but I'm trying to figure out how what you would actually do as a tester in this situation. So if what you would actually do is ask me some specific question, then go ahead and ask me the specific question. Do whatever you need to do to resolve whatever ambiguity you think you see there.
Okay. Well, we've already determined that we're testing Windows Media Player, that this may or may not be the very first test that I run.
Yeah.
Thus, reboot the test system might mean simply boot the test system. I don't know, for example, whether it's important that this be done from a clean boot, even.
Well, settle the question.
I have to settle the question by asking you, or by at least inferring a context and you can tell me that I'm wrong about it, but
you can ask me anything you want. I'm here to be asked. So let's. Okay. I'm trying to play out a realistic scenario, and I have a completely realistic scenario in mind. Something that actually happened on a real project. So, and we can role play this completely realistically.
What was the name of the product that you were testing?
I was testing Windows XP Embedded.
Windows XP Embedded. Embedded in what?
It's a product called Windows XP Embedded. It's one of the operating systems that Microsoft produces.
Okay. It's to be embedded in a desktop machine or a handheld machine or what?
Well, in anything. It's a version of Windows XP, which is designed to be used for embedded systems, which means that you can compose from pieces different versions of Windows XP.
Okay.
So I was preparing different versions of Windows XP using Windows XP Embedded, and then testing the resulting operating system with a variety of applications, including Windows Media Player.
Okay. What is the test system in question?
The
Can
test
you describe
system is
that for me?
Windows XP Embedded.
Okay. Well, I see a larger system than that. I see a hardware platform as well. What are we running it on?
Oh, you mean what hardware? Okay.
What physical thing? Yeah.
We're running it on a set of more or less generic PCs. I've got five different identical PCs. I don't think they're even brand name PCs. They were generic store brand PCs from built from parts.
What comes at step three?
Well, then we're going to do a series of things with Windows Media Player to show that Windows Media Player is working with Windows.
Okay. Has Windows Media Player been tested on this platform before?
Maybe. Well, certainly after the first time that you run this, it will have been.
Okay. As my sponsor, would you prefer that when I read reboot the test system, would you prefer that I read it from the perspective physically reboot the machine or simply restart the operating system?
You mean warm boot or cold boot?
Right.
I don't think it matters. I think a warm boot would be fine, but I don't know for sure. I think a warm boot would be fine.
Okay. So, my default assumption would be to do a warm boot most times, but to vary that behavior. So when it says reboot the test system, I might pay more attention than usual to the notion of turning my machine off and turning it on again more frequently than I otherwise might.
Why would you vary?
Pardon me?
Why would you vary your behavior? Why wouldn't you pick one thing and go with it?
Because if it's a problem in which rebooting is implicated, the chance... I would prefer to put myself into a situation where I can see either kind of problem, where a problem that happens on a cold boot doesn't happen on a warm boot and vice versa. So I would vary my behavior for that reason.
Because you want to see more problems?
I want the potential to see more problems. Some problems might only happen because I cold booted.
But this is a customer acceptance test.
A customer acceptance test. Well, I'm not convinced that matters. If the customer wants me to test, then the script will not. The script isn't sufficiently clear for me to be sure one way or the other. I'm fine with varying my behavior if that's what the customer wants, or if the customer wants me to stick to it.
This is a
I can mostly do that.
Obligation that I have.
Mm-hmm.
After we've finished the product,
mm-hmm.
we've already tested the product.
Okay, so people have been testing it.
I am doing a demonstration.
You're doing it.
This is intended to be a rigorous demonstration.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm concerned about the variation that you're talking about. Furthermore, I'm the vendor. I'm not the customer.
Okay.
It's one thing for a customer to do a customer acceptance test.
Indeed.
They may very well want to maximize the chance of finding problems. But what our project goal is with this test is not to maximize the chance of finding problems, but to demonstrate the capability of the product to do certain things.
Oh, okay. So this is kind of like a dog and pony show for internal customers? Is that
yes.
what I'm reading?
Well, for external customers.
For external customers.
Yes.
So this is like a demo.
Yes.
And we want to show them that this product is working beautifully. Is that right?
We want to show them that we have that they can accept the product under the contract.
Okay. So there's some confirmatory stuff that you want us to do here.
Exactly.
Not actually really testing.
Not testing in the aggressive sense of maximizing the chance of finding every problem.
Okay.
And therefore, I'd rather that we pick one way and go with it rather than introducing variations for variation's sake.
Okay, fair enough. Have these when your test script is finished here, will we have run this test script before?
Will we have run it before? What do you mean?
Okay, so we're going to do the dog and pony show.
Yeah.
And we are going to follow this script.
Yeah.
Will this script have been run, this exact same script, have been run at some point in the past? Because you want to minimize the chances of finding a problem here, right?
Well, I should say that it's not that I want to minimize the chance of finding a problem. What I want is a highly defensible set of tests. Defensible in the sense that I can demonstrate to the maximum, my maximum ability, that we did run these tests the way that we claim to have run these tests. I may have to testify in court that I ran these tests.
Okay.
So I want to be maximally prepared for that.
Okay. In that case, can I make a suggestion about the script?
Sure.
It's up to you to decide, or we can collaborate on the decision. But when it says reboot the test system, I think it would be well for us to specify that we're going from either a cold boot or a hard boot.
Why?
Well, because if we don't specify that, then there is all kinds of ambiguity, and we'd have to defend that in court. We'd have to depend on the note-taking capabilities of our testers, or on some recording that we make of them, so that was specifically handled. If specificity of each and every little step is important, then we better specify each and every little step.
But how little a step do we need to specify?
Well, I think in this case, that would be one of them, whether we're starting from a warm or a cold boot. And probably the means of starting Windows Media Player would probably be good, too.
But where do we draw
Again,
the line?
Well, we can keep going. Every time I spot something where I think you could get in trouble, we'll be here a while, mind you, but any time I spot something that could be, I think could be interpreted, has a good chance of being interpreted badly, then I'll ask for more specificity.
So can you rewrite that step one the way you like it?
Okay, the first thing is power down the system. If on, and boot from a cold start. Now that's still ambiguous, but I think it's a little bit cleaner.
Because you think that cold versus warm is relevant.
No, I just want to minimize the chance that when we repeat this test, that we do something different if the goal is not to find problems, but to demonstrate that we've done exactly these
Well,
steps.
but you know that we are going to do something different. Every time you run a test, you do something different. It's impossible to do the same thing twice. In
Of
the
course.
physical world, nothing can be done twice in exactly
Absolutely
the
agree.
same way in every conceivable dimension. And the only people who
Absolutely.
think that something can be done twice are people whose imagination is not expansive enough to help them see the many dimensions of reality that exist. So I noticed that you say power down the system, but you're not saying how to power down the system. We could, for instance, turn the power off. We could actually turn the power strip off. We could also click the little button. We could instead click the little button, which is just a little push button, which when you press it once, it powers down the system, and then you press it again and it powers it up again. We could press that button. We could also press and hold the button, which does a hard reset of a different kind. So you haven't specified those things, and
Okay.
presumably that's either because you haven't thought of it yet or because you think it doesn't matter. Now, what makes you think that a cold start and a warm start, that is a difference that matters?
On a cold start, and I remember this from testing essentially operating system extensions, various kinds of hardware, including things like sound cards and DVD players and CD players and so on, get a certain amount more reinitialization than they get than they would say if we simply logged off and logged on again, did a warm restart, press the button and held it in.
How is that relevant to testing Windows Media Player, though?
Windows Media Player is something that acts fairly intimately with display and audio hardware. So if I suspected a problem, one of the problems might be platform interaction, I guess.
Okay.
Part of my model includes that. Now, obviously, like every other application that runs on the system, Windows Media Player is intimate with the hardware. That could be said of everything, depending on, again, what
Now
matters.
you have another reason to think there it makes a difference too, right? Besides the technical reason.
Well, I have some experience with systems that didn't work right in cases where the hardware was being warm booted, but not where it was being cold booted.
So
So,
you
if that's
have
what you're asking about.
experience and you have a technical reason and you have another reason besides experience and besides the technical argument as well, right?
What's your suggestion here?
Your client has expressed concern about it. That's your third reason.
Right,
If
absolutely.
I didn't if I said, "Oh, whatever, I don't care," then that would tell you one thing, but I said, "I'm concerned that you keep changing it because I want us to stick to one way of doing it." So that sounds like I'm concerned. Now, if you said, "I'm always going to use my pinky finger to turn the switch off," then I might go, don't be ridiculous. Who cares?
It's funny where you cross that line, isn't it? When the line between, oh, don't be ridiculous, that couldn't possibly matter, and oh my God, that's like the most essential thing. How could you miss that?
Well, let's say that you were in a shooting competition where you're shooting high-powered rifles a half a mile. It isn't altogether absurd to say things like, I always use my pinky finger on the hair trigger,
That's a great example.
right? Because I can easily see a chain of causality based on the physical parameters of fingers and triggers. We don't see that kind of technical reasoning in this case, and therefore we shrug about it. But always recall Jerry Weinberg's story about the women with nylons who were making the computers crash.
Yeah.
You know, and
Or
I.
J Jonathan Bach's story about jiggling, or J Jonathan Cole's story, rather, about jiggling his leg.
Yes, that's right.
You
And
remember that one?
I recently visited a company where I had to wear a lab coat, not for fashion reasons, but because it was a rule. It was a special anti-static lab coat, and I had to wear special anti-static shoes. And unless I did that, I was not allowed to go into the lab to watch this testing.
You know, this really reminds me of a bit from Sense Making in Organizations. This is where Wyke is quoting a fellow named Smith, G. F. Smith, not G. E. Smith, the guitar player. G. F. Smith talks about a problem. Wyke says, the strength of Smith's definition of a problem is its implication that problems are conceptual entities that are designed rather than discovered. His careful explanation of this point is worth quoting in full. And Wyke, so now I'm quoting Smith instead of Wyke. Smith says, since a problem is an undesirable situation, it does not exist strictly as an objective state of the world, nor as a subjective state of dissatisfaction. A problem is a relationship of disharmony between reality and one's preferences, and being a relationship, it has no physical existence. Rather, problems are conceptual entities or constructs. The term is an abstraction from the world of observables and is applied because it serves a useful function. Essentially, the term is an attention allocation device. Marking a situation as problematic is a means of including it in one's stack of concerns, placing it on an agenda for future attention and solution efforts. Thus, there is an element of arbitrariness in labeling a situation as problematic.
Okay, and the same thing could be said about steps in a test procedure. So, I'm going to add this step, step zero. Get dressed for testing. This is a step that I have never seen in a test script, but it occurs to me that in some laboratory environments, you actually have to do this. You actually have to put on special shoes, a special coat, maybe special gloves. You have to do something special to equip yourself to perform the test.
Well, not only that, if I show up naked on the first day of my contract, if I haven't got dressed for testing already, like put on shoes and a shirt, pants, underpants. Many organizations require you to be dressed.
You have to wear underpants when you're testing?
I feel I do.
Wow. I bet a note to self.
Yeah, well, okay. Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, let me try this step on you.
Okay.
Step 0.1. Assure that power is coming into the building. Now, would you suggest that step 0 or step 0.1 be added to the test? Because I could argue that step 0.1 is a necessary prerequisite to step 1.
I was testing one day at quarterdeck when we had a power failure.
So power failures are possible.
Well, they're also blocking problems.
So tell me.
You can't really proceed until step 0.1 has been accomplished.
So
certainly not in my
true.
Office because it was interior. It wasn't a window office.
That's true. So make an argument against step 0 and step 0.1.
Well, they're inferred. They're unnecessary. I mean, we assume
inferred?
That absolutely we assume that you're going to be dressed. I mean, unless it's not important. So if you're testing at home, I guess under.
So is it possible for someone to be inappropriately dressed for testing?
It's certainly possible for that not to matter too.
Okay, so are you thinking we can eliminate these steps because they are not in danger of being performed, of being forgotten?
I think that unless it matters, I mean, the context that you're talking about where you're doing clean room testing of physical things or you know, having to wear the lab coat as being part of a corporate standard, if that is important to, you know, that we get dressed in a certain way, then we put it down. On the other hand, if the culture supports it, that is to say, you know, we don't have a torrent of naked people coming in to test or, you know, people who are wearing hats that are too tall to enter the door or something like that. If this isn't a problem, then I don't think we have to note it.
You mean we look and see what the consequences would be of not putting a step in?
Or the probability of that step not being inferred by a reasonably well-informed tester.
So this is a, in a sense, it's a what you might call a consequentialist theory of test steps, which is the consequentialist theory of ethics says you have to look at the impact of behavior. What are the consequences before you can decide if behavior is right or wrong, good or bad? So we can say, what would the consequences be of removing this step or of not putting this step in, even though this really is a step, you could argue? What would the consequences be of taking this out? Would the consequences be that it would have a likelihood of a reasonable likelihood that someone would do the wrong thing? Another thing to say is, what problems does having this thing create? Even if it solves a problem, what problem is created? What negative consequence comes from this? A problem I have with both of these is that they dilute the instructions so that people who are glancing at these and they see what they think of as obvious, they start thinking that all the instructions are obvious. In other words, if any instruction is uninformative in the view of the person using the script, then they may decide that all of the instructions are uninformative, even if there really is critical information there in some of it.
So, is that an example of anchoring bias, where you get in your head that, oh God, all these steps are trivial, I'm going to ignore them all?
I think it may be, because basically you form an impression of the person who is talking to you by looking at the things that they choose to say. And if somebody says, hey, stupid, I have to tell you this because you're probably so stupid that you need to know, if I feel that that's how I'm being addressed, then I may react very differently to a script. So although these are arguably truthful, important things, I'm going to eliminate them because I don't feel that they are sufficiently informative in this context. But I can imagine contexts where those would be important factors and involve complex skills. Like maybe if we're testing a 25 megajoule laser, we have to do some sort of special check of the power system before we try to power up the capacitors.
But, you know, I'm concerned with that example a little bit because I think we could find one that's a lot closer. You know, for example, a situation where we're testing network cards. Reinitializing the network card at a certain point in the test process might be really important. That may or may not appear in a script in places where they're doing that kind of testing. In places where the culture says, oh, it's obvious that you do that. And, you know, obvious things being obvious to people to whom they are obvious, and obvious things being very subtle to people who don't recognize that they're obvious. Obvious is a tautology.
I'm concerned about this wording here because you're saying power down the system and then it turns out that that's a conditional. Isn't what we're saying boot from a cold start and then the test system from a cold start, power down if already on, something like that?
Well, yeah, but they say the same thing, don't they? They're just expressed a little bit differently.
Well, they're expressed differently. And the point I'm making is that the step one, as I've written it, puts the instruction, the key instruction for that step, right up front. And then provides, as a parenthetical, a resolution of some ambiguity. If someone says, but it's already booted, we're saying, well, power down then, if it's already turned on. Now, what if you approach this step? First of all, let me ask you this. How do you do step one? Tell me exactly how do I do step one with a ordinary desktop PC?
If it's an ordinary desktop PC, my mode would be to press the power on button, and then to invoke a whole bunch of other strategies if certain kinds of expectations weren't met on my part. For example, I would expect first and foremost the screen to show some activity.
It shows activity.
Okay.
And there's a bunch of garbage on the screen.
Oh.
And then it disappears.
Is it that Flags of All Nations sort of effect that we used to see?
Yeah,
it disappears.
Sure. And then that garbage disappears. And then there's a blank screen. And then it comes up with Windows and the little scrolling thing, progress indicator thing. And then it comes up with Windows XP a moment later.
That's weird, because the garbage part, I was thinking about a manufacturer's logo at that point. Because on both of my systems, I think what happens when I boot it up from a cold start is that it tells me something about the BIOS information or something like that.
Yeah, well, this one doesn't.
Oh, it doesn't?
Yeah, it just comes up with, for a few seconds, it's got that garbage on the screen, then that disappears, then Windows pops up. Says Windows XP embedded, and it does the little scrolly thing.
Now, you see, I didn't know that, because if two things were true, if I had some experience with this line of machines, and if I were paying attention, which is an issue, I might suspect a problem if I saw garbage in the place that you described. I might suspect a problem wrongly.
Well, there's nothing in this test script that tells you that that's an issue that you should even be worrying about.
Yeah. Do you think I should?
Do I think you should what?
Worry about it, noting that this is machine is somewhat unusual in this respect, that it doesn't show me the logo. It just shows me garbage.
So you're speaking to me as your client at this point?
Sort of, yeah.
Okay, so I could answer you this way. I could say, whatever, I don't think it matters.
I'm wondering then if I should have a sort of a different step zero from the one that you had, which is step zero, be prepared to report anything that in the following steps suggests to you that it could be a problem. Wouldn't that be a great step zero to have in the test scripts?
Be prepared to what?
Be prepared to, at any time,
yeah,
report something that causes you to suspect that there might be a problem.
Well, that's pretty vague.
It is pretty vague.
How do you do that step?
Well, see, I don't know, but I think it's awfully important that we do that.
Well, how do you do it?
I
guess I agree with you that it's important to do it.
Yeah.
So now, how do I do that?
How do you do
it?
Do
I need a step 0.0 that comes before that?
That establishes whether or not there should be a manufacturer's logo just before
you
see the
Windows
logo, for example.
No, that tells me how to prepare to report anything that I might need to report. And do I need a step 0.0.0, which tells me how to prepare to prepare?
Yeah, we'd have to do a lot of onion peeling to get down to that, wouldn't we?
So do you really think we need that step zero?
I don't know. What are our testers like? What do we know about our testers?
You are the tester.
Oh, I am the tester?
So what do you know about you? Is the question.
Okay. We described three heuristics that I would use to ask questions about the script. There's a ton of other ones that I use. But, a good example is the hiccups list from rapid testing. If I see something that's inconsistent with past history, if I see something that's inconsistent with the image of the company that's producing the product, if I see something that's inconsistent with comparable products, if I see something that's inconsistent with claims that are being made about the product.
And all those things relate to a more fundamental idea, which is that you report things and you prepare yourself to the best of your ability, prepare yourself as well as you might reasonably be expected to prepare yourself.
Yeah, like getting dressed in the morning.
Yeah.
To That's a good start.
Report, to observe and report anything that you, in good faith, determine is worthy of your client's attention.
Yeah, you know, that's so important. You'd think it would be on the script somewhere, wouldn't you?
Well, no, because if we were going to put that on the script, we'd have to put lots and lots and lots of things on the script. I think
right.
We need to draw a sharp line somewhere between the special thing that is true about that test and the things that are true about all tests and the things that are true about all testing. In other words, all tests in our series might have certain commonalities, and all testing on our project might have certain commonalities, certain cultural expectations. And to take all those implicit cultural expectations, or even explicit cultural expectations, and add them in as steps on specific tests is ridiculous. It's unworkable. Well,
does it matter then if we boot the test system from a cold start?
Well, that's what I'm getting to. Because once you decide that you're going to draw that line, then you apply that principle to each step in the test and say, is this part of that culture that we have? And how do we communicate that culture? We may communicate it in several ways. One way that we can communicate it is through a systematic training of the testing staff. Another way we may communicate it, in addition to or instead of that, may be a document which describes the general expectations and requirements for running this set of tests. So we put all that stuff in one document instead of replicating it in each little document.
Yeah, I don't trust the HR department to have that one up to date. But
no, I don't either, but that's another way we may do this. Another way we can do this is we can have a test lead who is supervising the process, and the test lead knows this information, and the test lead personally assesses and guides the testing to assure that the requirements are met. And the test...
Well, there are variations on that, too. There's pairing testers with other testers, so there's a collaborative nature.
But I'm talking about a control system. So if you pair testers with other testers, as long as those other testers know what the norm is,
right,
then, and they can agree on the norm, then they can communicate that norm to their partners. What I'm saying is, if there exists a norm, then we can communicate the norm with documentation, which tends to be expensive, or we can communicate the norm human to human, which tends to be far less expensive, far more natural. It is often considered to be less reliable, and in some respects it may be less reliable in every little detail. In other respects, it may be far more reliable, because as we've seen, I can write step one, reboot the test system, and I can know what I mean by that. But you can not know what I mean by that. You happen to be sharp enough that you know you don't know what I mean by that. Too many testers think it's obvious what I mean by that.
Not just testers, but test script writers.
Now let's say that step one has already been done. Boot the system from a cold start. All
right. Did that, right?
No, you didn't do it. Somebody did it, but not you.
Okay.
Okay, so does that mean you go to step two, or does that mean you do step one again?
I can envision there being, on the screen, a large amount of text in white letters on a big blue screen that says something. At that point, my heuristic says, I don't care if somebody's already booted this thing. I think I'm going to have to boot it again.
In other words, you are saying that you can assess the state, and there could be things that you see that could cause you to question whether step one was completed successfully?
That's right. And just as dangerously, there would be things that I can't see which do not cause me to question.
Okay, so let's talk about this situation. The screen is a grassy field with a blue sky over it, which you recognize from seeing Windows XP booted many times. You see a handful of icons. This is what you recognize as a machine that could have been just booted. The test assistant you're working with just told you that the system is freshly booted. Okay. So do you go on to step two, or do you do step one over again?
Well, one question I have, actually, is Windows Media Player showing right now?
No.
No, it's not. Are there any other applications up on the screen right now?
No.
Because the test assistant who just booted the system for me may have done things of which I was unaware that could matter to our existing test. For example, the test assistant could have swapped out the CD that we could be attempting to listen to through Windows Media Player.
So are you saying that no test assistant can save you any work by doing some of this?
They certainly can, but there's again, just as there is with the script, there's a set of assumptions about what they've done.
So
I
how do
think
we
you're,
control those assumptions?
again, sociocultural kinds of things
Such as?
where, well, if the assistant told me, oh, by the way, I changed the CD, then that could have a bearing on what I do next. If the test assistant was giving me some information beforehand that would suggest that I either should or should not reboot this machine. What did the test assistant say again?
The test assistant says, I did step one already on all these systems. They are ready for testing.
So I have to have a good faith approach with them too.
A good faith approach?
Yeah, that is, if there were something that they were not telling me, then I'd have to believe that they had executed step one, they had not done anything else, and that they had also had a common understanding of what step one is shared between me and the author of the script and
How
themselves.
do you attain this shared understanding?
Through practice, through working with such people, through essentially through developing an understanding of what we mean by what we say.
Okay, well, that's spinning your wheels in the mud. Now give me
Sure is.
some
Yeah,
kind
well,
of content.
absolutely.
Now put some sort of content behind your words that I know you are capable of, or I can tell you what I think would be content.
What time in the morning is it?
It's
What's our
9:17
relationship?
AM.
Okay.
And I
And
am your test assistant. And I
oh, you're my
said,
test
and
assistant.
I'll
Okay.
play your test assistant. And I
All right.
say, Michael, I've done step one on all of these. These systems are, there's five systems here. They are all booted and ready.
Okay.
So what would we have to have done before, or what would you do now to establish the kind of common understanding? And you said, well, by working together and practicing, well, that's vague. I want you to be more specific.
Okay.
And I can be if you want me to just give you
Sure.
the answer.
We may have performed this activity before. So if it's Thursday and we've had a talk about it, or if I have never experienced something that surprised me based on how the system were rebooted, I think I would need to have an understanding of things like accounts because somebody has logged into this system. Are they using the test account? And is that a matter of a shared understanding or a discussion? The issue is that there's a whole whack of assumptions that I would even find it hard to express here and now in my imagination
Okay.
because I'm not terribly conscious of absorbing that information when it actually happens. I don't think I'm any different from anybody else that way either,
Okay.
in that there are various sorts of cues and various sorts of
Well, then let me
things that happen in the course of a day.
try it.
Go
Let me
ahead.
try answering the question. I would have a conversation with you at the time that we start working together. My conversation would be something along these lines. Okay, Michael, we're going to be working together on these tasks. These tests have to be done in a very specific fashion. We need to do these tasks in the same way over and over again. And when I say the same way, I mean that we need to understand what's important to keep the same, that we can keep the same, and do those in the same way, and things that don't matter don't matter. So we've got to learn, you and I have to learn what those items are. So for instance, each of these tests needs to be run from a clean machine. Do you know what I mean when I say a clean machine? And then I would listen for the answer. You know, if the task assistant gives me a definition of a clean machine that I recognize, then I won't bother explaining clean machine. But if I get a hesitation or something like that, then I would say what I believed a clean machine was. And I would talk about how a cold boot is an important part of starting from a clean machine.
Now, this is your first day working with this test assistant.
Yeah, I would be basically going over what it is that I think are the expectations I have. What is my vocabulary? What do I mean when I say reboot? When I say reboot, I always mean a cold boot.
Now,
unless
mind
I say
you,
warm boot, you know, that kind of thing.
Now, mind you, this is a new project you're working on.
Yeah.
And you've actually worked with this tester for 8 months.
Oh, I've already worked with this tester?
Yeah.
What I'm telling you, Michael, is how I would create the expectations. Now, if you tell me I've already worked with the person, then I can't talk to you about how I would create the expectations.
Mm-hmm. But my point is that if you have worked with the person, it is unclear how those expectations may or may not have been created.
Well, that's why we would review it then. If I think that these expectations are suddenly important, then I would review it. Now, part of what I would do is I would say, here's a step. Reboot the test system. I want you to do this now on this system while I watch you, okay? Go ahead. And I'd watch what the guy does. And I'd say, I'd ask him some what ifs. Because I'd be thinking, how can this process go wrong in ways that he would have to recover from them going wrong? So I would say, what if it boots up halfway and stops? What if you get that message that says, do you want to boot into safe mode or would you like to boot normally? What would I expect the tester to do? Well, one thing is I would expect the tester to say, I got this strange message from this machine. Yes, it's booted up, but there may be some problem with the machine.
So it's step 0.05 then is to make sure that everybody else you're working with has this same kind of basis of understanding and reports those things in good faith, because they might see something that's sort of unusual, like they boot the machine and the time is 12:34:56, right? You could display, see, the current time displays on a little clock as part of the boot process.
Sure.
But that's pretty unusual.
But
that's not a problem.
I'm basically giving you the same answer you gave back to me, but I'm taking the word, like you said, practice, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm doing is I'm taking that, I'm opening that up, and I'm telling you what practice actually means to me. It means mm-hmm. that I model the situation and I identify important things that I'm going to expect the other guy to do. I'm going to watch that person do those things. I am going to anticipate different ways those things can go wrong. I'm going to talk about what I would expect him to do if those things go wrong. I would give examples and example reactions that I would expect him to have. And then what I would do is I would try to contrive situations that challenge that tester's understanding. And I would
just to see.
Yeah. In other words, I would create a situation where I personally booted up all the systems. And then I talk with the tester for a while, and then I'll say, get these systems ready for the tests. And then I would watch to see if the tester reboots the systems or doesn't reboot the systems, but instead says, oh, well, they're ready to go right now because I just saw you reboot them. And then I would talk to that tester. If I expected the tester to do a reboot of the system, even though having seen me do it, then I would talk to the tester about how I want them rebooted. So
for example, you'd watch for other patterns of behavior, like you cold booted, they warm booted.
Exactly.
And you'd watch for inconsistencies there.
Right. And what I was looking for is for them to be, maybe I was telling them that whether they were warm-booted or cold-booted or whatever doesn't really matter in this case, because we can be testing from a slightly dirty machine. It's not that big a deal. Then I'm looking for that tester to do a different kind of optimizing behavior. I would look for that tester to say, well, based on my knowledge of these systems, I just saw you reboot them 10 minutes ago. I think they're ready to go right now. And that might be really what I'm asked. That might be what I expect from that tester.
You know what's really hilarious about this is that a few minutes ago, as you recall, I told you that, I'll have a look and see what the manufacturer's logo says on my machine when it boots up.
Right.
What I did was I shut down the system that's sitting in front of me right now
by
clicking on start and clicking on shut down.
Yeah.
And a bunch of things happened slowly. And for about the last 10 minutes or so, I've seen this screen in front of me, which says Windows is shutting down, and it's not doing anything. So it's funny how life imitates art.
It appears to be doing nothing.
It appears to be doing nothing. It has been sitting here for 10 minutes doing nothing at all. What you're talking about reminds me very much of the idea that when people write scripts, they are going through this process very rapidly to the level of it being subconscious or not consciously at all. And that is fascinating.
Yeah, what I'm trying to do is teach people how to become conscious, to get conscious about these things in situations where it really matters to get it right. And then if it doesn't matter that much, then don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a lot of how the line between scripted testing and exploratory testing must be drawn. You've got to decide, when you decide to commit something and lock it down in a certain way, you're working with a theory of learning, of how people will learn to run these scripts. You're working with a theory of communication, of course. You're working with a theories of variation and repetition. You have your idea of risks. You have your idea of what the mission of the test is. You have your idea of what belongs to this test procedure and what belongs to testing in general. What belongs to testing culture in general and what belongs to this particular project situation. And you make your decisions, if you make them thoughtfully, based on these factors. Now, let me tell you why this matters so much.
Or you make them unconsciously based on those factors too, though.
Well, I'm trying to advise people in how to make them consciously when it matters for them to make it consciously. So, in other words, if I were to stop and say, I want to be careful now, am I able to be careful? And furthermore, under what circumstances where I'm not being careful should I wake up and begin to be careful? So what are heuristics that might tell me, hold on, wait a minute, this requires me to slow down? Like, say you're driving along a highway and it turns to a dirt road, or there's suddenly icy rain starts falling, you might realize, hey, I've got to get off cruise control, I've got to slow down.
Red lights in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, red lights. There may be a variety of things, fog, that cause you to say, I've got to grip the steering wheel a little tighter, I've got to drop my speed. And these are environmental or situational triggers. It's not that the thought comes to our mind completely unbidden at random, it is time to be careful now, or is it time to be careful now? But there are certain cues in our environment which may cause us to become careful. And so
some of those, by the way, are meta. Some of those are meta cues. My friend Skip had a wonderful little metaphor that he used for that. He called it the time to reef metaphor. Reefing is the process of rolling up a certain part of the sail, rolling up a bit of the sail, and exposing less sail to the wind when the weather is getting heavy, right? You reef to control the amount of exposure you have to a big wind. So he said, if you're on a boat and the wind is coming up and you wonder if it might be time to reef, it's time to reef. If you're on a mountain road and the question comes into your head, is it possible I might be driving too fast? You are driving too fast. That was the heuristic he used, and it's reminds me of what or you reminded me of that there, that one of the things that happens when I'm testing, it certainly happens when I'm driving, is this idea goes through my head, whoa, time to reef.
Yes.
Because I think I you know it's not that I see a problem, I think that this might be a place where I might see a problem,
Okay.
and that causes me to change my behavior.
So let me tell you why this matters to me, this example that we've been working with. I had to testify in court years ago about some testing that we had done on Windows XP embedded. And I discovered a few days before my planned testimony that the tester had done all the tests ignoring step one, which on each test was reboot the test system. In order to save time, he had run the tests strung one after another in a flow test fashion, rather than running the tests as atomic independent tests by rebooting the system each time.
So he had tested, in fact, then. I infer from your story, but not necessarily from the script. He ran a dramatically different test from the one you thought that he had run.
Yes, and I was very angry when I found out that he had not done this. And how I found out, by the way, is I went over each of the scripts and said, "You did this step, and you did this step, and you did this step," right? And he
Man,
said,
that must have been
and it
tedious.
was. I had to do it. It was all part of the preparing for trial. And he said, "Oh, well, I didn't always do that step." Well, why didn't you do that step? Well, because it takes a lot of time, and I thought it would save time.
That's weird because it was right there.
Now, reboot the test system, in his mind, meant turn the computer on unless it's already on.
Right.
Now, this fellow was not a test designer, and I knew he wasn't a test designer. So I recognize this as a failure in training on my part and a failure in supervision on my part, because he was, from his own lights, doing something reasonable. I had witnessed him run the test correctly, and I had said, "Yes, that's correct. Do that." But the problem with "do that" is the problem with any specification by example. You know what I mean? Specification by example. Someone says the product should work like this, do something like that, and you never know what is actually being understood by the person that you are talking to. They nod and go, "Okay, I'll do something like that," but you don't know which that they're talking about.
Well, that's exactly how magicians work too, right? They give us a specification by example. See, I put my hand here, and I put this cover here, and when I lift up the cover, it's gone. And we get astonished by magic tricks because when we perform according to that example, we don't get the same result, right?
Yeah. So when a cat jumps on a hot stove, are they determining that stoves are dangerous, or are they determining that you should never jump onto anything on a Tuesday because there's a possibility you'll get burned? Now, because cats don't know what a Tuesday is, they're not going to come to that inference. But if they did, they might, especially if you arranged for the stove only to be hot on Tuesdays, and they knew how to read a calendar. Or if you made stoves always were green, it's the only green object in the cat's world, and then
Well,
maybe
it's
the
interesting.
cat associates the color green with pain. So, in other words, I had told the tester, "Yes, that's correct, do that." But the tester did not understand why, did not understand what the point was of the step. That's why we just went through this whole conversation, because I've not explain anything about the point of these steps. And you mentioned right at the very beginning of the conversation that there's a variety of context variables you'd have to know.
Mm-hmm.
And if we were to continue and get specific on that, I suspect that it would come out. Well, it did come out. Why it was that I wanted the system booted in a certain way, you drew out of me of how I wanted to minimize variation and why I wanted to minimize variation. And so that could give you the necessary sensitivity to go ahead and interpret the rest of the test script in some reasonable way. But there may be a lot more that we have to talk about.
Welcome to outsourcing, eh?
Well, that's exactly why I'm doing this. Because if you have a test where step one is performed by an assistant and step two is performed by a tester, it's a similar problem to all the steps written by one guy and they're all run by another guy.
All performed by assistant. In fact, worse, because typically in such circumstances, the assistant and the designer, they've never met at all. They share little to no context. The contextual information they get is by at least one other set of proxies. There isn't typically face-to-face, voice-to-voice communication. You know, if you're designing these tests for an outsource organization, there is no confidence you can take from the idea that any one test is going to be executed by the same person who did the previous test. So there's not only a problem of a depth of understanding, but also a breadth of the community to whom you're speaking. When it's just a one-on-one person in the same shop, you can have a mutual understanding about what's going on that's vastly different from your mutual understanding if you are one person talking to 80 at a test lab in another country.
Yeah. So we have things that are important but unnecessary, unhelpful to write down. Things that are important and necessary, helpful to write down. And we have a process of synchronizing expectations. And I would summarize what we're telling people to do is to recognize that scripts, any test procedure that is written down, is embedded in a whole soup, a vast sea, really, of things that will not be written down. And we must recognize that that is true, and we must realize that there are many things that are wise not to write down because they're so much more effectively communicated by demonstration and personal training.
Or not necessary.
Supervision, or not necessary at all to write down. And so we must have an understanding of which things matter, which things don't. If they matter, how to express them so that we have a common understanding, how to express them to ourselves so that we control them effectively, even if we're not trying to have anyone else understand them. We need to have a sense of what do we do if things go wrong, because just stopping isn't an option. And that means that if we do hand scripts off to someone who is not a test designer, then how do we help them deal with test design problems that pop up in the middle of them trying to do this work? And the same thing is true, of course, with automation. We need to understand how the tool is affecting what we're doing and how we can work effectively with the tools, which are just going to do certain brute things in repeatable but unimaginative ways.